Thank
That's
you.
That's my meter. I just put some code.
All right, today we're going to start an 8-part series on history, Jewish history. We're starting with the destruction of the Second Temple, and we'll be headed up towards the 1600s. I'm hoping after I speak to Rabbi Lieberman to get up to the 1700s, because I really feel like I want to hit to that. Although it depends on if you're doing history next time. I don't want to have to rush, but anyway, we'll see. So what I want to start with this time, I'll be doing 5 of the 8. Mordechai Meshori will fill in for 3 while I'm in Israel, but I have these first 2 right now. So I want to start with a quick review to bring us up to speed, and then today we're going to talk about destruction of the temple and laying the foundations of Christianity and the Bar Kokhba revolt, so there's a lot of things to squeeze into this class. So what I printed out for you is the first 2 pages of Rabbi Ken Spiro's timeline from Aish.com on a crash course in Jewish history. So not only does it give you a quick timeline that we can look at, which is not complete because it is a crash course, but it also gives you his article numbers in case you want to look up a little bit more about that time period, remembering that it's a crash course, so they'll be quick and easy to read articles. So I personally, just so you know, am using that crash course, Rabbi Beryl Wine's tapes, and some of the references that they quote to prepare for this class. And I'm trying to remind myself not to remember all those details because it's the main story that I want to convey here, the story of history, and not necessarily all the names and dates, because we want to get sweep of history and what actually was going on. So basically, we started out together, I think. I'm not sure where we began when we were studying history together. But you can see from this timeline, beginning of Abraham, but I want to bring us down to kind of where we were talking. So let's just look 825, middle of the first page, or the second, 2/3 into the first page. First temple is completed. Then with that, King Solomon begins his rule, and he rules with the first temple there. He completes the first temple. So this is 825 BCE, right? So close to 3,000 years ago. Not quite. Then Israel split into 2 kingdoms, and the Assyrians overrun the northern Israel, the northern kingdom, which is where the 10 tribes are lost. It's interesting to think about today how many Jews there probably are in the world, because we count ourselves at about 14 million. But if you think about the fact that Judaism is passed on through the mother, whether you accept it, understand it, believe it or not, right? It has nothing to do with how you practice and what you believe. It's completely who is born to a Jewish woman that makes you Jewish. Then those 10 tribes still exist. It's not like they were wiped out. They were lost. They assimilated. They disappeared. They dissipated into the nations. But they're still Jewish. And so are all of those descendants from all of those women. Still Jewish today, but they don't know at all. So it's like I had a babysitter when I was in Long Island, a Catholic woman, who she was so fabulous with the kids, and such a Long Island accent, and she decorated her house up to the hilt for every Christian holiday. So I'm bringing my little Jewish children to this complete, like, you know, Christmas city in her house. But she was so good at playing with the kids, and she had a Persian boy in the playgroup also. She told me, she said, she loves people from all countries. They all have something to learn from everybody. She said, you know, my mother's mother was a Jew from Russia. Oh. I was like, your what? Your mother's mother was a Jew from Russia? I said, Margaret, that makes you Jewish. She said, I am? I said, yeah, you are. She was so Long Island. And they played with Bobby dolls. So, but here she is, I mean, her grandmother came from Russia and married a Catholic, who had a daughter who married a Catholic, who had her who married a Catholic. So she didn't identify at all as Jewish. She had no clue, and yet she is Jewish, and so is her daughter. So there's plenty of Jews like that around. We just don't know them, and they don't know them right now, but they're around. So that's 10 tribes, something to think about. Then Sennacherib attacks Jerusalem. The Babylonians conquer Israel and destroy the temple, so that's the destruction of the first temple and the beginning of the first exile that we count in our count of 4 exiles is the Babylonian exile. Is this ringing a bell? I'm bringing you back, I hope. So the quick review. So the Babylonian exile is the first one. So the Babylonians did not want to kill us. They wanted to conquer us. So their method of conquer was to conquer and exile. so that they took people out of their land to destabilize the population of the land, so that people wouldn't rebel from and not, and they wouldn't have the home court advantage of knowing their land and their territory. And they also wouldn't feel that fidelity to the land and the need to rebel, so that what would be left over is just the need of a human being to have self-rule. But he wouldn't be at home and he wouldn't be defending his land. So you take away like two-thirds of the rebellion energy by picking them out of the land and moving them. So that's what the Babylonians did. They took the Jews and they brought them to Babylon. So that was the first exile. Some of the Jews, it should say here in 370, returned to Israel from the Babylonian exile, but not many. Meanwhile, you have the miracle of Purim, which is really, I'm not sure exactly of his timeline. My understanding is it went straight from the Babylonian exile right into the Persian exile, which is the story of Purim, because the Persians took over Babylon, basically. So the Jews stayed in the same place, but the exile was named something else because the rulers changed hands. So then you have the miracle of Purim, and then right after that is the construction of the Second Temple. So that's 352 BCE. Then you have the time of the Great Assembly. So that's the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, the men of the Great Assembly, the sages that are the leftover prophets from the Babylonian exile. So if you remember, at the construction of the Second Temple, when they tried to restart, create the Second Commonwealth, the sages at the time prayed. The First Temple was destroyed because of idol worship, right? Because the Jews were unfaithful, actually. It's a spiritual adultery that they committed. And so they were taken out of their land. So, by the hands of the Babylonians, but by divine decree. So, after that spiritual adultery, the Jewish leaders realized this type of idolatry is so attractive to the Jewish soul that we have to take away the desire for it. Somehow, that has to be removed because it will just go back. So they pray, the leaders pray, please God, take away from us the drive for idol worship. It has to be gone from us. We can't, otherwise we won't be able to rebuild. So God did take it away, and along with that, who remembers, for extra gold stars, what also was taken away from the Jewish people to balance it? Excellent. I'm going to bring gold stars next time, remember? You get the gold stars. So prophecy was taken away because idol worship was taken away. So prophecy, there always has to be a balanced environment in which we can make our decisions so that free will can be exercised. So it can't be too out of balance, right? So if idol worship and the drive for the negative is taken away, then the balance of the positive has to be taken away too. So that's prophecy. And so now we're left with the Second Temple without prophecy, but there were a few prophets left. So prophecy was taken away starting up, but there were still a few who were alive. And those were incorporated into the men of the Great Assembly.
How do you take away idol worship?
It was a spiritual thing. So the drive for it was taken away. It's kind of like, you might be old enough to remember, I don't know if you were in college, was communism a thing? And when you went to college? When I went to college, which wasn't that long ago, but I guess it was, before the fall of the Berlin Wall and all that stuff. So there were still college students in 1985 tabling for communism, passing out pamphlets and saying how great it was, and it was still like part of the student rebellion to be interested in communism. Look on a campus today, there's nobody into communism. It's gone. The desire for it is gone, at least from the left in our country. So that energy has been taken away. There's other stuff. There's other stupid things that we're following and chasing, but not that. So the Jews, too, there's other things that we chase, but not that. So that's maybe more natural, or possibly it was divinely ordained that the era of communism and those isms is over, and now we have other things to chase, other trials. But that's gone. So in a similar way, does that help you understand this a little bit? Okay. Okay, so now we have the Second Temple, and the Greeks come in and they conquer Israel. Now, the Greeks actually did not want to destroy the Jews or necessarily the religion either. The Greeks were all about conquer and absorb, not conquer and exile. So they particularly wanted to absorb things that were beautiful. Now, the Greeks, as if you remember, were very attractive to us. Remember the Babylonians, who said, we're not. The Gemara describes them as hairy bears, right? They were very boorish. And so when the Jews went into Babylon, they were not at all interested in absorbing the Babylonian customs. They didn't assimilate. They remained aloof. But when the Greeks came in with their poetry and their mathematics and their philosophy and their architecture, the Jews were all about that, you know, because it's brain candy. And Jews love that intellectual pursuit, and they loved it. They were so attracted to Greek culture. And the Greeks also loved beauty, and clearly the Torah and its philosophy is beautiful. And so they didn't want to destroy that. They just wanted to absorb it and bring it into their service of beauty, not the service of God. So that was the third exile, was the exile in which our eyes were darkened. Darkness, the exile of darkness, where our bodies were safe, basically, and our land was safe, and our temple was safe, but we weren't, our minds weren't safe. We were led astray, we were darkened, which is why we light Hanukkah candles to relight the Jewish intellect, to shine light into the darkness. So we weren't totally safe. I mean, there was definitely war and destruction, and, you know, in the end, they took over the temple. They did not destroy the temple. They just took it over to make it pagan. So because they wanted to bring their religion into our beauty rather than learning about our beauty. And it's interesting to think about that the Jewish goal is transcendence. Right, to elevate everything physical into a transcendent level, into relationship with God. The Greek goal is beauty. So art, music, beauty, these are all things that bring the human being from the workaday existence into a level above that. Right? You can't go into art and poetry and theater until you already have a roof and food and you're secure. Right? So stage one of humanity is just that security. Stage two is something more, but stage three is something even more than that. But really, the Greek world is transition between workaday and divine transcendence. So Jews are about divine transcendence, but Greeks are about that in-between stage. So, but you can end there. If you end in that stage, then you're just going into nothingness. You're just beauty for beauty's sake, not beauty for bringing the human condition up into various levels. So that's what the Greeks were about, beauty for beauty's sake, in a nutshell. Let's see. So that's why we have the Hanukkah story, revolt of the Maccabees against what they're trying to accomplish, the miracle of Hanukkah, and then the Romans invade Israel. So at first, that's a welcome invasion. We're happy to get the Greeks off our backs and the Romans come, except for then the Romans are on our backs. We're not so happy with that. So Herod the Great begins his rule. We talked a little bit about him. He's a megalomaniac. He was crazy. He killed his wife, his children, but he did build many of the structures that we still see in Israel today. The Cave of the Patriarchs, Marat Machpelah, is a Herodian structure. The walls around the Temple Mount are Herodian.
Question, wasn't Herod involved in building the second temple?
Yes, he rebuilt the, it's 2.2 version of the second temple. So it was the second temple, but it was the second version of the second temple. So the second temple was already rebuilt, but he wanted to make it great. He was a builder.
So who built the first version of the second temple?
So the returnees from the Babylonian exile.
I see.
But then he, it was on that little hill where the Dome of the Rock is today.
Yeah.
And what he did was he built walls all the way around the hill. And then backfilled it to make a much bigger platform so that he could build a much bigger temple on that spot. And so those are the walls that we have today. The western wall is the western retaining wall built around that hill. So it's not part of the temple itself. It is part of the wall that holds up the hill that Herod built to create a larger platform to build a larger temple. So that was Herodian. So Herod built all around. The walls of Jerusalem, too, were largely built by Herod and then rebuilt by Byzantines. But he built like crazy.
He had no relationship to the Romans then?
Well, he was happy to be in there. I think he was a puppet ruler. He was happy to serve them. He was a Jew. Apparently, he was descended from a bad line of converts. I think there was one, and I'm a little shaky in this, but I'm sure that there was one incident where a small town was converted by force. the only time in Judaism that we have conversion by force. So it did not work out well, and he's descended from one of those forced converts. We don't, as you know, we don't seek converts, and we don't make it easy for people who do want to convert. So forced conversion is completely antithetical, can't really work, and so it didn't. You see, you end up with a guy like this who was crazy, although
Romans
technically
were around
Jewish.
When he was alive.
Yes, 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 absolutely. So back to here. So Herod the Great begins his rule. Then Hillel and Shammai began their teachings. So that's 32 BCE. So CE being Common Era, as everybody knows, which means that we're talking about Jesus is born right around here, right around time of Hillel and Shammai. Because really, it's not that he's born at zero. What it does happen at zero? Is that where we count his birth? I guess so, right? So it's not clear where he's born exactly, really, truly in history, but around here. So it's important to understand what's going on. I'll get to that in 1 second. So, time of Hillel and Shammai, great revolt of the Jews against Rome begins in 67 CE. The temple is destroyed in 70. Okay, so that brings us up to right now. So we're going to back up a drop. So that's our review. Now we'll start with today's class. Okay. So, so what's going on with Hillel and Shammai? So Hillel and Shammai are the heads of great institutions of Jewish learning. And there's quite a bit of Jewish learning going on at the time. It's the Second Commonwealth. The Romans are in charge. But it's going pretty well so far. I mean, there is a tightness around the Jews, but they're still able to study. But the Romans are there, and they have quite a bit of contact with the Jews. And the Jews, because of various things, are dispersed around the kingdom, the whole Roman kingdom. So the Jews, in some places, make up 6%. Some places up to 20%. So that there were places, there's a port city in Rome, I wish I remember the name, but listen to Barrel Wine Tape if you want it. There's a port city in Rome that actually had it was closed on Shabbos. There was so much Jewish activity that entire city was closed on Saturdays. So it's interesting because since they had such a rhythm of shutting down on Saturdays, as the Christians came a little later than that and said, well, our Sabbath is on Sunday, so we don't want to work on Sundays. They said, forget it. We can't have 2 days a week off. We have a day closed. That's the day that we have where businesses are closed is Saturdays. We can't do two in a row. So it really was an ingrained and established practice that in some places there were enough Jews who were practicing around the Roman diaspora that Jewish practices were a part of the rhythm of life. So, but that being said, what impact does that have on the Romans? So the Romans around are coming into contact with the Jews and their thoughts. And the Roman practice was to conquer and absorb also. So they conquered and would use religion, use the various religious philosophies that they encountered to ingratiate the people that they captured, and then to dominate the people that they captured. And they shifted philosophies to say, you know, we're in charge, we're whatever God you believe in, we accept that God, and he's kind of like our God, you know, our whichever one you want to pick. And that's why you should follow what we have to say. And they mushed up philosophy and religion and the sword and conquering and absorbing all these religions to a point where they got to a place where they had 30,000 gods. And over 150 holidays a year. So it was really unmanageable. And the Romans weren't stupid people. And they were in contact with Jews and their monotheistic thoughts. And they got to a place where they said, you know, it's really ridiculous what's going on. All these gods and all these holidays, and it doesn't make sense. And monotheism is pretty interesting, except there's only one monotheistic version so far in the world, and that's the Jewish one. Not easy. Circumcision and lots of mitzvahs and restrictions, and it looks really hard, and we don't want that whole package. It's too much for us. So there were some who just kind of left Roman ideology and moved into more of a monotheistic concept ideology, but they were floaters. They didn't really have community or direction or how to practice it, much like the B'nai Noach of today. There are some Noahides who are Gentiles, who are not Christian, but are Bible and God believers who don't want to convert to Judaism. So great, they believe in God. They believe God gave the Bible. They believe the Bible is true. They believe the Jews are the chosen people of God. They don't believe in Christianity. Okay, so they're Gentiles. They're Torah Gentiles. But what are their holidays? Where are they buried? How do they get married? What are they supposed to do? Well, who's their community? They float. So a lot of their children end up converting to Judaism because they need a community. There's no place to tie in for them. There's no anchor. So you had Romans like this who were starting to move in that direction. So that really left a vacuum for a new concept of monotheism, which is where Jesus came in. Anyway, it was a time, excuse me, anybody who's seen Life of Brian, it was a time of many different messiahs rising up. I do have teenagers, and I actually used to be one. So when I watch these things.
Mm-hmm. I thought the Romans had really enslaved the Jews. So when you talk about
yes.
the sport city, I mean, because they would like parade the Jews around and belittle them in public.
There was enslavement of the Jews for sure, which we will get to in just a minute.
Okay.
And there was widespread enslavement, especially during capture times. And Jews were great to capture, whether for slaves. They make good slaves. They work hard. They're smart. They don't take direction very well, turns out. So they don't make that good a slave in that sense. They have their own opinions about how things should go. but they are smart, and so in that sense, they are good. But they're also good to capture, even if not as slaves, because we're a whole community. And we believe in redeeming captives. And so Jews were frequently kidnapped on boats by pirates or taken from city to city. But Jews were great to catch on a boat. If a pirate would take over a boat and there were a few Jewish passengers, kidnap the Jews. The next port you come into, you just tell the Jewish community, we got six Jews, you know, how much will you pay for them? And they would ransom the Jews. So to a point where it really got really got problematic, and they had to put caps on how much they were paying because the Jewish communities in different places were really being extorted, and Jews were at risk all around the world for kidnapping because we're one family and we redeem each other. So yes, definitely Jews were, it was not pleasant during the Roman times. I'm just saying that the academies were able to begin, but it got tighter and tighter and more difficult and more difficult. And the Jews were a political threat. Not so much because they're big in number, but two main reasons that are both religious. One is the Jew believed that there's a king of kings. That's very frustrating for a Roman king, emperor, Caesar, who thinks he's the king and a god. Because in their god concept, just like Pharaoh believed he was a god. So they also, I mean, I'm sure they knew inside themselves, but they also tricked themselves into believing that they're God. Certainly the populace behaved like they were one. So if you believe that there's a king of kings, so then you're really saying there's something in charge of you. You're not in charge of everything. So that's a political threat. But the other huge threat that the Jews posed was that they were willing to die for their religion. They were willing to die for truth. And so no other people was like that. At the time, the Christians later on took that on, but the Jews were the only ones who held so strongly to their beliefs that they were willing to give up their lives to defend it. So it made it very difficult to threaten people who were willing to die, right? Because you couldn't say, we'll kill you if you don't, because they were okay with it. Not okay, of course, but they understood that there was something more important than being alive, which was truth. And that there is a transcendent life also, that you're going to have a next world. So this is only a physical body. Yes, we'd like to stay in it as long as possible. And our soul lives forever. And so we're responsible to that forever soul. And that goes beyond this physical world. And we understood that deeply. And so we were hard to control. So it wasn't easy being a Roman ruler of a bunch of Jews. They're hard to rule. So you have this then environment in which the Romans, who are smart enough, are starting to feel like, some are beginning to feel an uncomfortableness with their 30,000 gods and their multi-holidays, and are interested in a monotheistic religion, but not in Judaism. You have a bunch of different, the Jews were waiting for a Messiah. This was a time of difficulty for the Jews, so hope for a Messiah. And also philosophers and street teachers at the time, different people talking about different religious things. So there were messiahs around, or philosophic leader types trying to preach different ideas. So in that, in that you have Jesus born, and whatever happened with him, whether he, who knows what the account is exactly. You certainly have the New Testament accounts that you could look at as some kind of historic thing. And then Josephus, bless you, and his historic accounts, which are interesting. Josephus is living at right about this time also. I'll tell you about him in just a minute. So so you understand, anyway, there's a little vacuum here waiting to be filled. So now you have the revolt. The Jews finally decide they're going to revolt against Rome. This is in 67, the great revolt of the Jews against Rome. So what happens here? It's interesting that Paul, the publicist of Jesus, is killed in 67 in Rome at the time. So the things are really beginning to churn even more. So you have the beginnings of Christianity, which is initially a Jewish sect. So Paul, Jesus doesn't preach this, but Paul takes it to a next step. First, Paul is called Saul, and he's a loyal Jew, and then he takes a little break for a few years where he has his visions or whatever he has that helps him transition, bless you, into believing in Jesus. And, I mean, so I'll just say it from a Jewish perspective and not politically correct. He really is an opportunist, and he sees, here's a chance to start a new religion for all these people who are really interested in something monotheistic, but not all the rules. So he takes Jesus' teachings and he moves them, which are Jewish teachings, so the love, the caring, the one God rules everything concept, which is very soothing after you're thinking that so many gods rule everything and fate is the God of us all, you know, that you're mercilessly blown from place to place with no control at all. The thought of one God ruling it and having an actual plan for it all is a nice thought. So he's able to take those ideas and divorce from them the obligations of Judaism and say, Jesus fulfilled the law. You don't have to do it. All you have to do is believe. Believe in the one God. And it wasn't even yet the Messiah concept so much. That developed later in the Council of Nicaea. But at this point, it was basically, Jesus fulfilled the law. It no longer needs to be done. So you can have monotheism without the law. Those two things are separate. So that was Paul's big contribution to Christianity. Torah. Yeah, because our concept is that the law is what brings us to the relationship, all right, with God. So you can't have that. The relationship with God has to be manifest in something. So just like a bride and a groom, a husband and a wife, do all these little things and big things to show their love and to build their relationship throughout the years, so we too have to do that to engage in relationship with God. So it wouldn't work if your husband sat around saying, I love you, I love you, I love you, but I just don't feel like going to work or supporting you at all, you know, not financially, not emotionally, I just love you, right? So that's nice, but I'm sorry, that's not a relationship. We both take out the trash, we both work in whatever ways we can to support this family, to support each other, we make room for each other, we move over for each other, we move in for each other, all kinds of things, constantly, small things and big things, from putting coffee in a favorite cup to, you know, going to work every single day, rain or shine, to make sure that there's a roof and food. You know, so all of that is about building a relationship. But you wouldn't do it without the hope of the relationship. The purpose is the relationship in the end, not just doing all that stuff. Not just working to work, you're working to build. Right? Working to create a home and a life and a future.
The rewards.
Right. Right, the rewards of the relationship, of the stability, the stability actually is also a means to the end, but in the end it's for the relationship, for the family, for the future.
Closeness or whatever.
Pardon?
Closeness.
Yeah, for whatever you're trying to create, right. So we feel very strongly about the law being there as the set of physical engagements that we engage in order to create relationship in this world. So Christianity said, no, you can have the relationship without any of the physical stuff. You don't need any of that. And that's why they moved into asceticism, and that's why many of their clergy initially was ascetic and still Catholics today. No sex, no marriage, no, because no physical necessary. And poverty, they take a vow of poverty, of chastity, of obedience, right? So we do too, in a way. You know, poverty, send your kids to day school, you'll get it. Right? And chastity, so and the laws of family purity, so half the month is on and half the month is off, so you get to practice of that too. Obedience, for sure, all day long. So, But there's a different concept of that. Anyway, so that was Paul's main contribution to Christianity, was divorcing the one God concept and how you create a relationship with that one God from the Torah. So, but that was a problem also for the Romans, because that opened up this Jewish sect to non-Jews, to Gentiles. So that was also Paul's big bridge, was opening up monotheism, a monotheistic path, because initially it was a Jewish sect, so it was only open to Jews, to all the Gentiles. So that opened up, he removed the impediments and opened the floodgates, basically. And people were able to pour in, which meant it was a huge political threat to the Romans. Huge. So the Christians were, whether they were or weren't, but probably were, killed by lions in the Colosseum. I mean, the Colosseum was built in Rome, which was a theater of blood sport. I mean, the whole point was to kill people and watch people get killed in it. There's a whole interesting article, I think it's in this month's Smithsonian, or last month, some right around now, about the Colosseum.
You have that issue.
About the Colosseum and the floors underneath it and all the platforms that went up and down to be able to keep lions in cages below and have them come up and just as if they appeared. And the Colosseum was an amazing architectural feat, I mean, even by today's standards. And everything that they had below, and it was amazing. But a lot of people were killed in it. That was the whole point of it. Not only were they killed, but people brought their families. This was a family affair. It was like going to Disney on Ice. Really, that's what it was. People brought their children and snacks and watched people be torn apart. That was
the vomitarium. You could go throw up.
The vomitarium was not for this. The vomitarium was so you could eat and eat and eat, barf and eat some more. Had nothing to do with losing your lunch because you see people dying in front of you. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. Oh, no. The vomitarium was just so you could enjoy more food. Yeah. Yeah. Because don't you sometimes finish a meal and say, oh, I wish I could eat more, but I am so full. Well, here is how you do it. Barf and eat again. That's what the vomitariums are about.
Ancient.
In terms of the
ancient
smell
bulimia.
That was inside the Colosseum also.
Yeah, that it made you sick and that you had to go somewhere to relieve yourself. Smell.
Interesting. I don't remember. I mean, that maybe.
It had to smell pretty rough.
I guess, but they have the open air, you know.
I have barfing.
Anyway, they were able to deal with that. I mean, people brought their children. This was part of the culture, that people watched this kind of death on a regular basis, this kind of killing, whether it was slaves or conquered people or political dissidents or Christians or whoever was there that was threatening, they were, you know, that's where people would go to get killed and watch it. So, so basically you have then... Paul is doing his thing, and he presents a big threat, and so he is in Rome. He's executed in 67. Back in the Holy Land in 67, the Jews begin their revolt, because the noose of the Romans is tightening and tightening and tightening, no learning Torah, and no Shabbos, and everything has to go clandestine, and it's very difficult for the Jews, and so they revolt against the Romans in 67. Now, the Roman kingdom was really rocked by the revolt of the Jews and the other things that were happening at the time, so that in the year 69... The revolt was a three-year-long Jewish revolt. In the year 69, in Rome, there were four different rulers in 1 year. So it was very rocky in Rome itself. And the Roman legions, which
are... Were they getting killed off?
Pardon?
Were they getting...
I think they were killed off, yeah, I think so. But whatever it was, there was no stability of leadership in Rome at the time. So, and a quarter of the Roman legions, they had a huge standing army, and a quarter of them were sent to Judea to quash the rebellion. That's a lot of Roman soldiers, several per Jew, were sent to Judea to quash the Jews. Finally, in 70, they managed to do it. So in 70, first the walls of Jerusalem are breached, and the Romans are encamped outside around Jerusalem. There's a siege in Jerusalem. The siege of Jerusalem was not just from the outside, so that the Jews weren't just pressed from the Romans on the outside, but on the inside there was a lot of infighting. The Jews themselves weren't clear about, as a group, how should we respond to this? And so the zealots, the religious zealots at the time, said, we are not giving in. And we will not leave, we will not be enslaved, and we will not, you know, give in religiously, and we won't be taken captive, and we don't want any of you weaklings ruining it for us. And so the zealots burned the food stores of their own Jews inside Jerusalem to bring the war to a head, so that they would shorten the amount of time that they could withstand the Roman siege, because they had less food, less supplies, so that they would bring the war more to a head, so that it would be less time for the weaklings to say, forget it, we're going to roll over and just do whatever they say. So there was fighting between the zealots and the other Jews in the city. But meanwhile, there was an agreement between the Romans and the zealots, so the Romans on the outside, the zealots on the inside, that at night, or just as it got to be night, they would open the gates to allow the dead to be carried out of the city, to be buried out. Because, as you know, we Jews are careful about the Tumah and Tahara, the ritual purity and impurity altogether, and a dead Jewish body is the most impure thing possible. And so, Tumah thing possible. So that has to be taken. We don't keep dead in Jerusalem overnight. So even today, if somebody dies in Jerusalem, they're buried right away, within hours. They don't wait for relatives, nothing. You know, they die, and they're buried within 3-4 hours. No overnight at all. They'll even bury, unless somebody dies at night, then they bury in the morning. But I think they'll even bury into dusk, they bury right away in Jerusalem. So they took all the bodies out then, to bury them out. And that was the only way to get out of the city.
Do you bury on Shabbos?
No, you don't bury on Shabbos. So you would have to, if somebody dies on Shabbos, you have to wait.
Even Friday, late Friday.
Late Friday, right. So it's interesting that there's stories of sages, and I forgot who, recently in the last 100 years, he knew where he had bought a burial plot, I think on the Mount of Olives, and he went, every couple of years, he himself would go and dig the grave fresh for himself, so that if he died on a Friday afternoon, it would be easy to dig it out quick. It wouldn't be impacted, so that he could be buried easily on a Friday afternoon. And he did die on a Friday afternoon. So he was able to be buried because of that. It was easy to dig out the grave. So, right. So usually, you're not going to break Shabbos to bury. But you do the second day of Yom Tov, you would bury. And not on the first day. Mm-hmm. Pretty sure.
So that could be tricky if it's Shabbos and then Yom Tov.
Right, then you do. And apparently it's very difficult, just parenthetically, for anybody who's dealing with death or relatives coming or whatever it is in your lives. We'll all have that opportunity, unfortunately. But it is, Jewish tradition says, bury right away, as quickly as you can. And so we do sometimes wait a day for people to come in, but it is considered a pain for the deceased, that the longer they're outside of the grave, the harder it is on them. And so we want to allow them for the final exit of the soul, there's still a connection between body and soul. Mm-hmm. Until burial, it's the burial that allows that exit, so that the connection is a pained connection before burial. And so we do want to give that, we want to be kind to the deceased rather than to the living. And so some people just have to miss a funeral, so that you can be kind to the deceased. So that is a thing we tried to bury quickly. Meanwhile, there was this agreement between the Romans and the zealots that they would allow the dead out. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, this is one of the names to remember for today. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was one of the leading sages at this time of revolt. And he realized, we're going to lose. We're going to lose Jerusalem. We're going to lose the temple. Things are looking very bad for the Jews right now. And it's my job as a leader and a sage to figure out a way to keep the Jewish people alive. And so he, probably through prophecy, Ruach HaKodesh, some kind of holy revelation, learned that Vespasian, the Roman general who was outside leading the siege, the leader of the Roman legions at the time, he was going to be the next emperor. 4 already in that year, and Rome now needed a strong guy. He was the strongest one they had, the leader of the Judean rebellion, the leader of the quasher of the Judean rebellion. They needed him. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai posed as dead in a coffin to get out of the city so that he would have a way to go and meet with Vespasian himself. So he goes out and he meets with Vespasian, and he tells him, you have been elected to be the emperor of Rome. And he said, how would you know that? You know, that's ridiculous. I'm going to have you executed. But I'll just wait for a little while. Meanwhile, the runner comes from Rome with the news. A few hours later, he comes and he tells him, guess what? You've been elected to be emperor. So now the custom in ancient times was to kill the bearer of bad news. So I don't know who would want to be a messenger at the time. I guess they just give you a sealed envelope and that's why you don't know what you're delivering. So, and you reward the bearer of good news. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, turned out, was the bearer of true good news. And so he was rewarded. So Vespasian asked him, he told him he would give him 3 wishes. What does he wish for? Now there's differing accounts in the Babylonian Talmud and in the Jerusalem Talmud of what he wished for. But basically what he got, they differ because you would think you could wish for, leave Jerusalem alone, leave the temple standing. Those are 2 of my wishes, right? But he knew that those were not wishes that could be fulfilled. That's not what was going to happen. They were going to be destroyed, both. And so his wishes had to do with saving the Jewish people. They sounded crazy to Vespasian, though. He felt like that was, what did he wish for? He wasted his wishes. So what he wished for was that the family of Hillel should not be killed. After the destruction, they should be left alive. Because what was common after a Roman conquest was to take the leading families, bring them to the Colosseum, and execute them publicly as part of "We Conquered You" fest. Right? So he said, please, the family of Hillel, please leave them alone. Okay, I'll grant you that wish. One family gets to live, right? One big family gets to live. Then he said, Rabbi Tzadok, one of the leading sages, who himself understood that the destruction was impending, because of his understanding, he fasted for 40 years during the daytime, every day. 40 years. So he was physically very weak. So he asked, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked Vespasian, can we please have proper medical attention for Rabbi Tzadok? That was wish number 2. Okay? And wish number 3 that was the most is the most famous of the wishes. I'll say it in Hebrew in case you ever hear it. It's Tein li Yavna v'chachameha. Give me the city of Yavna and her sages. So the city of Yavna is just outside of Jerusalem. And it had a little yeshiva. And said, leave that little yeshiva alone and its sages. Allow us to have one leftover Nebi yeshiva after you conquer our main capital city. So Vespasian is like, what, one family, one guy, and one little yeshiva? Those are your 3 wishes? Sure, no problem. So he felt like this old rabbi didn't know what he was asking for, and meanwhile, he saved the Jewish people. Because he saved a family of leadership. So what was happening here is that the leadership of the Jews was going from political leadership to religious leadership, right? The era of the Commonwealth, both temples and the leadership of the Jews over their land was over. So how are the Jews going to survive now through this long exile that we're still in today? Through religious leadership, not political leadership. Nobody, we have different political people in charge of us all around the world. But because we have a central religious concept, no central religious authority, we don't have a pope and we don't have a Vatican, we don't have that type of religious leadership, but we do have the concept of learning Torah, being attached to Torah, understanding Hebrew, being attached to Hebrew, and having sages that teach that and transmit it throughout the generations, that's what saved us as a people. And that's what he was setting up for us. Save this family of religious leaders, the family of Hillel, religious leadership. And then the power of a tzaddik, the power of a person, how all Jews are connected to each other, but we have some stars in every generation. They are part of us, just like our whole body is connected to itself, right? But we have eyelashes and we have a heart, you know? So some parts of our body are less important than other parts of our body. We have a whole Jewish people, we're all connected to each other, and some people function as eyelashes, and some people function as the heart. So a tzaddik is the heart of the Jews, one of the hearts. And so he said, save this tzaddik. We need that type of energy to be protected in our people. That type of energy flows, it pumps the blood through the whole Jewish people. We need to save that type of a tzaddik who cares enough to fast every day for 40 years for us. That example of a tzaddik. Save him. So he was saved. So the concept, that concept was saved. And then give me this yeshiva, this little yeshiva in Yavne, and it sages, well, the Torah. The Torah is our center place. We don't have our own land. We don't share a language. We don't share a cuisine. We don't share a dressing style. We don't, right? What do we share? All Jews from all around the world, we share the Torah, right? The Torah has to become something that's portable, something that can go with us wherever we go, so that we will be able to maintain our identity through connection to the Torah. And so that's what Yavne was. Outside of Jerusalem, outside of the heart, the beginning of the exile, a little further away from the center, is how do we create a Judaism that doesn't depend on temple service, doesn't depend on offerings, doesn't depend on the structure of the Kohanim and everything that we have in the land of Israel. How do we create a portable Judaism that can be severed from the land, that can function in absence of the land until we get the land back? So that's really, those were his requests. And that's what he was granted, was the ability to keep the Jews alive in the new reality that we find ourselves in today. Good, we still have a few more minutes. Excellent. Any questions up to here so far? Okay, so Vespasian then is going to be the new emperor, right? So off he goes to Rome. He has to leave somebody in charge, though, so he leaves his son, Titus. Titus is the one who does finish the destruction. And if you remember, in Rome, we have the famous Arch of Titus. Excellent. And the picture on it, right, of the Jewish slaves being that first pilloried, what's the right word? Pillared? That first took all the stuff from the temple.
Pillaged.
Pillaged. They first pillaged the temple, took all of its valuable things, brought it to Rome. And the arch is they made a victory parade through the streets of Rome with all the spoils from the temple, including the menorah. And that's the famous image that we see on the Arch of Titus, is the Jewish slaves carrying the spoils from the temple through the streets of Rome. It was actually a tradition among the Roman Jewish community to never walk under that arch until 1948, when the State of Israel was declared, and they made a big parade of all the Jews of Rome. They marched right under that arch and said, "You're gone, and we're here." But it's fascinating to think about what happened to Rome throughout the years, the sacking of Rome and all the tribes that went in and marauded and burned and sacked and pillaged and for thousands of years, but that arc is still standing, and so is the Western Wall, both as a testament to you tried and we succeeded, we're still here. Both of those could have been destroyed, but we are still standing today.
Let's see.
Pardon? And let's eat, right? Right. So, so you have the Ark of Titus in Rome and the destruction in the year 70. However, there was a group of Jews who managed to escape Jerusalem and set up shop at the top of Masada. So Masada, it was really almost the final, not quite the final, conquering was the top of Masada. They held out there for 3 years. At the top of Masada. So most of you have been to the top of Masada. You know what it looks like, right? It's a tabletop mountain, big flat surface, straight up. And they built, that was Herod, who built a huge place there in case he would need to run. So he created, in a way, Herod himself created the outpost for the Jews by creating an outpost for himself in his zealous building. So they held out for 3 years, and then, as everybody knows, they committed suicide up there. Now, it seems that while today we see that as an act of heroism, and there was an act of heroism in it, it is not the Jewish thing to do. And it was not looked well upon by the Jews and sages at the time. That's not what we do. There is a concept of saving ourselves from the slavery, and they knew slavery was coming, and that's where I said we'll get to the slavery. In fact, when Jerusalem was conquered, so many were killed and the rest were captured as slaves. So many Jews were taken as slaves that it actually flooded the market. And the price of slaves dropped so much that you could buy a slave for less than a horse. It was cheap to buy a human being. And it really impacted the world slave market because of all the slaves that flooded at that time. So the Jews on the top of Masada did not want to be slaves. They did not want their women to be abused. They did not want their children to be taken captive. And so they did commit mass suicide. Masada and also Gamla in the north, similar thing. They do have, I'll just read you this speech, if I could find where I put it, from Gamla, that's recorded in Josephus's book. Now, Josephus, somebody else I want to bring up, where is his name? I wrote it down. Yosef ben Matityahu HaKohen. Josephus is 100% full-blooded Jew. And he was a historian, an author. And he wrote the history of the Jews under the employ of Titus. So he was right there at the destruction of the Second Temple to record the whole thing, reporter in the field, getting interviews and drawing pictures, visual pictures, of what the temple looked like, what the Roman legions looked like, what the destruction looked like, what the siege looked like. He recorded it all. And he is seen by pretty much everybody as a very effective and reliable recorder of the events. Jewish history, 2,000 years later, has not yet decided if we like Josephus or not. We have decided that you can rely on his accounts, basically. But he was an observant Jew, but he worked for Titus, the conqueror. So, for instance, in his recording of the destruction of the temple, he says that Titus wasn't such a bad guy. And he didn't actually mean to burn the whole thing to the ground. What he meant to do was just to sack it, and the fire was a mistake. So it's not clear, according to other sources, if the fire was a mistake, it wasn't a mistake. He wanted to put Titus in a little bit better light. So those kinds of things we don't 100% rely on. But pretty much everything else we really do rely on. But there are some questions. So for instance, here's one of the questions. I'll read you this speech from Gamla. Right, so in Gamla, everybody committed suicide. So this is recorded in his in Josephus' book, the speech of the final speech of the zealot leader Eliezer ben Yair. Since we long ago, my generous friends, resolved never to be servants to the Romans, nor to any other than God himself, we alone, who alone is the true, just, and just Lord of mankind, the time has now come that obliges us to make that resolution true in practice. It is very clear that we shall be taken within a day's time, but it is still an eligible thing to die after a glorious manner together with our dearest friends. Let our wives die before they are abused, and our children before they have tasted slavery, and after we have slain them, let us bestow this glorious benefit upon one another mutually and preserve ourselves in freedom as an excellent funeral monument to us. But first let us destroy our money and the fortress by fire. And let us spare nothing but our food, for it will be a testimonial when we are dead that we were not conquered for want of provisions, but that according to our original resolution, we have preferred death before slavery. So they all killed themselves. Now the question is, how did this speech get into Josephus' book? Right? Who recorded it if they all died? So in Josephus' book, he says there were two women and a few children who hid out and didn't die and were able to bring the speech to him. Whether or not that's true, Ken Spiro points out that it was a device of historians at the time to include speeches in their historic accounts to spice them up and make them more interesting. So certainly it was true in concept. Were those the words spoken by him? Maybe not. But the concept that they did commit suicide together, or actually killed their own wives and children to protect them and then killed each other, and then one person committed suicide in the end. So that was Masada. I have 3 more minutes. Right, so I think I'll leave you here with the conquering of Masada, which is not the final ending conquering. I mean, we do consider the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple to be 70, Masada 73, but we have a final revolt 50 years later, which we'll pick up with next time, which is the Bar Kokhba revolt. So, and Bar Kokhba was considered by Rabbi Akiva to be the Mashiach until he died, to be the Messiah. So, we'll pick up next time with the Bar Kokhba revolt and then into the writing of the Mishnah and the Gemara and what happened after, at the end of the destruction. So, great. That's it for this time. Hate to leave you on a downside, but the bad part in history.
Where did this come from?
That came from, the timeline that I'm reading from came from Aish.com. Rabbi Ken Spiro's Crash Course in Judaism. And this is one of his chapters, just the whole timeline. I just gave you the first two pages of the timeline. But it has his articles here. You can look up the articles to get more information about each part.
Is there any mom here?
Thank you.